Today is Tuesday, August 15th, 2006. My name is Sandy Fehler, and I'm an interviewer for the University of Wisconsin-Madison Oral History Project. Today, I'm interviewing Caitlin Allen, Professor of Plant Pathology in the College of Agricultural and Life Sciences, with an affiliate appointment in the Women's Studies Program in the College of Letters and Science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Hello.
Hi.
We're going to start today with your early life. If you could talk a little bit about where you were born, when you were born, describe your childhood, where you went to school, any people in your life that influenced you on your future career and education.
Sure. I was born June 7th, 1957 in Göttingen, Germany. My father, who's a history professor, was working on his dissertation research there. My dad was an academic, my mother was a librarian, and although she did not go back to, she went to library school and then to work when I was in high school, so she was a stay-at-home mom. I was the oldest of four kids. We moved around a lot, and it was a very humanities-oriented household, and I think my parents were puzzled that I ended up with an interest in biology. But we did spend an unusual amount of time in the natural world, in that my family has a summer house in Upper Michigan on an island, and because of the nine-month appointment that my dad had, we would spend 3 months a year up there. And even though we did move around a lot from one university to another, we always spent summers there. And there weren't many other kids around my age, and so I spent a lot of time out in the woods and reading, and it was nice. It's an important part of my education. My parents were socialists and passionate believers in the public school system, so I often went to rather bad schools, notably in Detroit and in Buffalo, New York. So it's a good thing that there were books for me to read in the house. Why did I get interested in science? I have been interested in biology since I could remember, and laboratory science in particular became more and more exciting to me as I learned more about it. I read a lot of science fiction when I was in 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th grade. I think a lot of scientists have that in common in their background. Rockets to Mars, xenobiology, all kinds of things like that. My dad, because he wrote book, had a publishing contract, occasionally would get textbooks as gifts from publishers. And I remember he had Leninger's Biochemistry, in which I'm sure he had absolutely no interest, around the house. And that college-level biochem textbook was very exciting and interesting to me. And I remember reading that a lot. And the other thing that we had, again, for some random reason, was the Time Life Nature series. And I remember reading those and drawing on them for school reports and things like that. I had an exceptionally good biology teacher in both the 8th and the 9th grades. And I think that those two teachers got me even more excited about biology. Kind of kept me from going down biochemistry road. In Buffalo, New York. And my 8th grade teacher did a little teaching exercise where she took a goldfish and wrapped it in a piece of damp tissue so that it wouldn't die and spread its tail out under the objective of a dissecting microscope. And we looked through the objective, and you could see the valves in the veins in the tail opening and closing as the fish's heartbeat and the little blood cells zipping through and then pausing in the between beats and then moving again. Everything was all golden and glittering and illuminated under the microscope. And I remember that as this kind of transforming moment of the unseen world made visible. Mm-hmm. And 10-minute experience, but it thought, oh, I really need to work with microscopes more. This is really nice. So then I went to Swarthmore College, where I...
Now, let's back up.
Okay.
Where did you graduate from high school?
I graduated from Bennett High School in Buffalo, New York, which was a public school in a not particularly good district. It went from being 30% African American, 70% white when I was a freshman, to exactly the opposite, when I was a senior. So it was a school undergoing a lot of social transition.
Mm-hmm.
And to tell the truth, I didn't spend a great deal of time in class. I was editor of the school newspaper. I was on the debate team. I did some interview program for a local radio station, public service thing. And I can't even remember what all else, but I was really good at getting out of class. So,
and are there any other scientists in your family? Any of your brothers or your siblings?
No, everyone else belongs to what I think is now referred to as the creative class. My brother is a builder and a carpenter. I have a sister who's a landscape architect and another sister who's a chef. No, I'm an outlier.
Okay.
My grandfather was an MD, a small town general practitioner in Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
And the story about him is that he grew up on a bit of a hardscrabble farm in southwest Michigan and managed to get off to college with the intention of becoming an engineer, and went into one of the classes he was assigned, calculus, on the first week of classes, and saw a bunch of derivatives up on the board and asked the instructor if he would have to take calculus if he was going to medical school. The instructor said no. My grandfather said, well, in that case, I'm going to be a doctor. And he was. So I don't know if it's true or not, but it's a favorite family story. But I did not know him. He died when I was 3. So I couldn't say. I have an analytical turn of mind, and I don't know exactly how it came to pass that.
And how did you choose Swarthmore?
I babysat when I was in high school for a woman who went to Swarthmore, and she said you should go there. And I applied to other places. I got into Cornell and Wellesley and Radcliffe, University of Michigan, where my dad and my mother went, and they wanted me to go there. It's Swarthmore. I think that was it. And I got into everywhere I applied, but I went to Swarthmore because I liked it when I visited it. My father was very unhappy that I could not go to Radcliffe. I remember him saying, it's a meal ticket. But all the women I talked to when I visited Radcliffe complained about being ignored by the faculty in their classes in favor of the male students. The dorms were a study in contrast. The men's rooms at Harvard were very nice. They were these old, you know, faux Cambridge kinds of stone buildings with fireplaces in the rooms and so forth. The women at Radcliffe were in an ugly brick high rise off campus, or felt off campus anyway. Meanwhile, Swarthmore was full of people who were a little offbeat, very, very, very smart, very intellectually intense. And as it happened, once I got there, I felt like, oh, for the first time in my life, I'm not a freak. It was, I mean, I was not socially, I was out of it in high school. It was just not like other kids. So anyway, Swarthmore was exciting. I double majored in English and science, in biology.
Mm-hmm.
Did better in my English classes, actually. But at some point along the way, I ended up, because of a boyfriend, leaving Swarthmore, going to Maine, and graduated eventually from the University of Maine at Orono with a degree in botany.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point along the way, literary criticism began to strike me as pretty sterile, and biology was more and more exciting, and I thought, I'm going to be reading literature all my life, which has pretty much been true, even when I'm really busy. But if I can't afford to have my own centrifuge in the basement, I won't be able to do science unless I make a profession of it. So I did.
Mm-hmm. So. Did you know early on that you would be going to graduate school?
Yeah. I mean, there was a brief period of flirtation with going back to the land. I spent a summer working on an organic farm, and but it's brutally hard work, and plant diseases were a big issue for organic growers, usually a gold mine of pathogens. I mean, this farm was no exception. So I thought, you know, I'd rather go at this from the problem-solving end rather than the problem-discovering end.
Now, where was the farm?
It was in South Maine near the border with New Hampshire. There are lots of shishi restaurants along that coast of southern Maine and New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm.
And so we grew herbs and lettuces and things like that to sell to these restaurants.
Were there a lot of organic farms around there, or was this sort of the beginning of that movement?
There were not a lot, but there were some. Maine was a hotbed of organic gardening and organic farming. So
then you graduate. So you did that after you graduated?
No, I did that between between my junior and senior year. No, maybe between my sophomore and junior year, because then there was a summer when I worked for a plant pathologist at the University of Maine, a guy named Frank Caruso, who introduced me to plant pathology, and I worked in his lab as a student hourly laborer, washing dishes and making media, and then I worked with him on a research project over the summer studying something called apple replant disease, which is still not understood. We went around to a bunch of different apple orchards and collected soil samples, and he had a theory that mycorrhizal fungi, which colonize, are symbiotic, helpful, if you will, fungi that colonize apple roots, might be correlated with the absence of apple replant disease. So I looked at lots and lots of mycorrhizal fungi, which are cool to look at. They actually penetrate into living cells of the plant and form a little feeding structure there and live inside the plant cell without eliciting any kind of rejection or immune response, and how these two very different creatures contrive to live in such great intimacy is an interesting question. Still an interesting question. So anyway, I worked with Frank, and it became clear that if you want to do research in plant pathology, you went to graduate school. So he helped me decide which schools to apply to.
And those were?
Those were Cornell, again. University of Wisconsin and Penn State, I think. Anyway, I went to Wisconsin because he said it's the best of the three. And at that time, I had read an article for a class. I actually took a graduate class in plant pathology when I was an undergrad that Frank taught. And we read a class on elicitors of defense responses, a review article on elicitors of defense responses in plants. And it was written by Luis Sequeira, who was at that time a professor in this department and also a member of the National Academy of Sciences and a thinker of the first importance in plant pathology, an important leader intellectually. And I wanted to work with Luis. So I came to the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and in some part also because the then chair of the department, Doug Maxwell, was a very adept recruiter, I now realize. He called me up as soon as he got my application, and I was home for Christmas over Christmas break, back in Buffalo visiting my parents, and he called me at home, and I was overwhelmed. I mean, I was in debt at this point, up to my hips from loans I'd had to take out to pay for my undergraduate. The idea that anyone would pay me to go to graduate school, I was sufficiently naive that the whole idea of a graduate assistantship was a revelation. And so I was swept off my feet, and Doug said all sorts of nice things about how great I was and how much they wanted me. And the next thing I knew, this is an experience many people have with Doug Maxwell. I found myself saying, oh, yes, I will. And so I came to Madison and started graduate school here, but my then boyfriend, future husband, was unable to get into the program that he wanted to get into here in the wildlife department. And so after a year rotating here at Wisconsin, I left and went to Virginia Tech in Blacksburg, Virginia, where my husband had gotten in. Or he was not then my husband, but my boyfriend. And that's where I did my PhD with a man named George Lacey. And there I studied the role of plant cell wall degrading enzymes in the virulence of a class of enterobacterial plant pathogens, Erwinia keratavra, Erwinia atraceptica, Erwinia chrysanthemi. These are pathogens that cause so-called soft rot disease. It's usually a post-harvest problem, which means that we've all seen it in our hydrator drawers. It's when you try to pick up that carrot and it's gone to mush.
Ah.
That's Erwinia at work. So that's what I did my PhD work on. But that's a whole other story.
Well, were you satisfied with your education at Virginia?
No.
Oh.
It was not a good department. It's decidedly second ranked, and this was a decision that, you know, in terms of my career, going there was probably a mistake, but it seemed like the right thing to do at the time because the boyfriend. I have to confess that I didn't much like the South culturally. I liked Southern literature, I liked bluegrass music, I loved hiking along the Appalachian Trail, but it was the kind of department where an overtly Christian prayer was offered before every departmental social get-together. They had three faculty who didn't believe in evolution by natural selection.
Oh my.
This was in the early 80s.
Oh my.
And so I think I started at Virginia Tech in the fall of 81, if I remember right. Yes, because I graduated in 86. So that was, and I got into arguments with the faculty. There were some first-rate researchers at Virginia Tech, including an evolutionary biologist, David West, who I took a wonderful course from that really changed the way I thought. And my advisor was very loyal to me, and he was not an easy man to get along with. He had a wicked temper, but he was also, when he was in his right mind, very supportive. But the lab didn't know, no one in the lab had done much molecular biology, so we were inventing everything from the ground up, and there were problems that would have been trivial in a more experienced lab that took up months and months of time to solve in that lab. So no, my PhD was not what I would have hoped for. Politics down there were oppressive. In Madison, I feel like I'm in the left of center mainstream, but down there I was in the frothing lunatic fringe, and there were 15 people in town who you could talk politics with without starting a fight. So social interactions remained superficial if you wanted to keep it pleasant. And there was one movie theater. There wasn't much of any live music or drama. It's a school with an attached military corps of cadets. That was a shocker. The first night that I was working late in the lab and I heard all this shouting and running around outside the building, and I looked out the window and there were people in camouflage face running around in the dark having, you know, war games in the bushes. And then there were people in uniforms marching around during the day. It was a weird atmosphere.
Now, so, did you get out of there as fast as you could?
I did, yes. Yeah. I didn't waste any time. So, or at least I tried not to. I mean, I did waste time, as I mentioned, because technically the lab was not as effective as it could have been. But I got lots of opportunities to teach there, and I taught twice in their general plant pathology lab, and then I also, working with George Lacey, designed a new course, and I was responsible for the design and teaching of the lab on plant-associated bacterial genetics. So that was a nice opportunity, maybe one that I wouldn't have gotten in a larger department. Sure. And I discovered that I liked teaching and I was good at it. So
then what happened the day after you got your PhD?
I packed my bags and moved to France.
Oh!
I was ready for somewhere a little more cosmopolitan. I defended my dissertation on a Friday, and on Monday I started my new postdoc in Lyon in France, working still on Erwinia, but in a laboratory that had started off as an E. coli genetics laboratory. E. coli belongs to the same family, the Enterobacteriaceae, as this plant pathogen group, the Erwinia. So it meant this group in France had cleverly figured out that all of these genetic tools, which had been developed in the late 70s and early 80s for use with E. coli, could be transferred to this group of plant pathogens, and it would be much less competitive. The biological, in terms of other people working on the same research problems, the biological questions that were possible to address were different and much more interesting, at least to some of us, than those having to do with E. coli in the lab flask. And it was an interesting lab in many ways. George Lacey ran a somewhat strongly hierarchical lab group. It was a small group. and he was really insecure. So he worried about publications. He discouraged me from submitting papers to better journals because he didn't think they'd be accepted. We were scooped at one point during my PhD thesis. Another lab finished the same project that I was working on before I did and published it, so I had to change projects. And, well, I mean, those things happen. I remember just losing it completely, and George's technician, who was a very wise woman, wiser than George, came down and found me in the bathroom where I was having a little snivel, and she said, "Do you think you're the first person this has ever happened to?" She said, "Pull yourself together. Come on, let's go figure out what you're going to do instead." And was much more useful than a whole bunch of sympathy would have been. So in any case, I applied for and got this postdoc in France in the lab of Jeanine Robert-Baudouy. And she had a very different kind of lab. She had this long history. There were people in the lab who'd been there at that point for 10 years. The same laboratory group with many of the same people are still functional, still working at the forefront. All these years later, I, you know, exchange correspondence with them and see them at meetings. Jeanine herself has retired. It was a female-dominated lab. There was much less machismo. No joking around about sex, which happened a lot with George. Although there were plenty of arguments and conflicts of the kind that are normal in a large lab group, they were less polarized and more likely to be solved instead of just shelved.
Were there other Americans in her lab?
No. There were someone from Poland. There was someone from China. It was a multinational group. But it was primarily French, and it was primarily female. There was one guy associated with the lab, but he was actually in the U.S. for a year and a half's postdoc during the 2 years that I was there. So he was gone most of that time. It was a very collaborative lab. They made decisions about which experiments needed to be done together. It changed the way that I thought about how research would work. It gave me a paradigm that was very different. So to give you an example, another graduate student started at the same time as I did in George's lab. And George gave us both the same project, and with the intention that whoever achieved it first would publish and the other one would have to start over. He thought it would be good for us to compete with each other. And we persisted with this for a couple of months, and the other guy was not much of a communicator. Finally, one night we were working late. I said, "Let's go get a beer." We were barely speaking to each other, you know. And we went and talked about it. We were both miserable. And we went in to see him the next morning and said, "We're not going to do this anymore. You have to give us each our own project. This is not nice." And he, to his credit, did at that point back down. But that was his approach. Mm-hmm. And then I came to this other group, and people talked all day long about each other's work and each other's results and why this line of work was or wasn't functioning correctly and what was likely to be more successful. And at first it was invasive. I remember walking into the building one morning, and one of the senior postdocs, Sylvie Revershun, who's now one of the lab directors, was opening up the incubator and taking out my plates from the experiment the day before and looking at them. And the answer to my experiment was whether or not there were bacteria growing on these plates. So she was just going to look and see if my experiment worked or not. She called me down the hall. It worked. And I was really annoyed. That was my moment when I would find out if it worked or not, and she'd stolen it from me. It dawned on me gradually that she was also going to be right there when the experiment hadn't worked, and I needed somebody to talk about with it and figure out why not. And so I eventually grew to really like that degree of interaction and interdependency, and I try to culture it in my own lab to the degree that people's personalities will adopt to it. Mm-hmm. And people vary a lot about that. So anyway, it was a good experience, that postdoc. in a very different way.
There was no language barrier?
When I showed up, I had to learn French. I mean, the summer before I left Virginia Tech, I took a six-week intensive French class at the same time that I was also writing my dissertation. It was kind of intense. And so I had a little bit of French when I showed up. And they published in English and gave talks in English at national and international meetings. So I had assumed that they were going to be sufficiently functional in English that we would have no problems. But in fact, nobody in that group really spoke good English. Mm. And so I needed to learn French, and I did pretty fast. Mm-hmm. My French is perfectly fluent, but I can't write or spell to save my life because I learned it in the gutter in the lab, more or less, instead of with a proper grammatical foundation.
So did you publish then while you were there, or did
you? Yes, yeah, we had a couple papers, and they were good. I was happy with them. Mm-hmm. So
then where did you go after that?
Well, at that point, my husband had come with me for at least part of the time. He had done a master's, not a PhD, at Virginia Tech. And to tell you the truth, I cannot remember now why it was that he didn't do a PhD. Did a lot of work there, and he ended up publishing quite a few papers from his master's. But he wanted to come here and try again to get into that lab that he had not gotten into before, the group at Stan Temple in the Wildlife Department. So we agreed that since he'd come with me to France, I would come with him to Madison. And so I then wrote to Luis Sequeira, remember him?
Yes.
And asked him if he, by any chance, knew of someone who needed a postdoc, and he hired me. So I finally did come and work in Luis's lab. And that was so I spent 86 to 88 in France, and at the end of 1988, I came here and joined Luis's lab, I think in January of 89. And worked as first a postdoc and then a scientist, which is another title, that allowed me to write grant proposals on my own in his lab, and began to look for jobs. I had my first daughter in 1990, and a little over a year after I got here. And my husband and I separated when I was 5 months pregnant. So I was a single mom at that point. Yeah, it's not the way anybody would choose to do things. So my daughter was born in March of 1990, after a really long week in the lab. I was trying to get these constructs made so that somebody else could be productive on the project while I was on maternity leave. And I'd been working really hard. I went home on Friday night and went into labor. And she was early. She was 5 weeks early. I have wondered if all the various stresses I was under at the time might have been partly responsible for that. She was healthy but small and sleepy. So the first few...
That's a good thing.
It was. Well, it allowed me to come back to work, which I did, and finished making the constructs that I needed to, and then I took some leave the first 3 months. The project here with Luis was on Ralstonia solanacearum, which is the bacterium that I'm still working with. It causes a disease called bacterial wilt, and it attacks a very broad range of plant hosts across a very wide geographic distribution, largely tropical and subtropical. It is considered to be the single most significant bacterial plant disease in terms of its impact on growers and general humanitarian impact. It's especially problematic for subsistence farmers and small-scale cash farmers in the tropics. So it's also a very interesting model system for a variety of biological reasons. So it's engaged my interest ever since. So I was working with Luis on that. I have to say I was not a very productive postdoc. I had one very substantial paper and another kind of okay paper that I finished while I was a postdoc with him. But I did get grant funding from the National Science Foundation and from the Department of Energy. And That was...
What kind of funding came from the Department of Energy?
They have a biosciences program. It's ostensibly linked to biomass conversion, the problem of how some plant pathogens can degrade plant material into potential fuels.
Oh.
But in truth, there's a significant amount of basic plant science research that's done under the auspices of the Department of Energy. And I'm not sure just exactly how that's, I think they call it basic energy sciences or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great program, but I don't know if it could be directly linked to energy and as we understand it, something that makes your car go forward. Certainly the ultimate source of energy, the sun, yes. So then it came time for Luis to retire, which he did in 1992. So in 1991, I went on the job market and interviewed at a bunch of different places. And also, there was this funny position here that I applied for because several people recommended it, but it didn't seem to me I was a very good fit for it. And that was a joint position between a biology department to be named and the Women's Studies Program. So the history of the position is that one of the founders of the Women's Studies Program was a woman named Ruth Blyer, and she was a neurobiologist who had a position in the medical school as well as a position in Women's Studies. And unlike many other Women's Studies programs, this one had, in addition to the usual humanities and social science interest, a focus on the natural sciences, specifically on the biology of gender and on women's health. And so Ruth had written a book and designed a course called Biology and Gender. And then she died in, I think, 1988, young, and her loss was much mourned in the Women's Studies program, I think, still. But they decided that they wanted to continue to have a natural scientist. And so they had this search, and I'm sure that they did not plan to hire a plant pathologist. But in the end, I guess I made a case that was sufficiently credible that they decided to hire me.
And that was a faculty position?
That was a faculty position. Meanwhile, back here in plant pathology, I had taught, by the way, in the last year of my postdoc, Luis Sequeira and I team taught a non-majors undergraduate science course called Plants, Parasites, and People, which was actually developed by Joe Handelsman, who I expect you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had done some teaching here in the department, and I think Luis must have put in a good word for me. In any case, they were willing to accommodate this peculiar position by giving me half a faculty line. And I don't know just what all negotiations went into it. I know that my letter of offer took a long, long time to produce, and it ended up having, I don't know, six signatures on it or something. It was complicated to do that. Cross-college appointments were less common then than they are now, and this one was unusual in many ways. I ended up having a 41% women's studies, 59% plant pathology position. To this day, I don't know how they came up with those numbers, but it gave an indication that a fair bit of horse trading was involved.
Right.
And I was to teach biology and gender, women's studies 530, and also plant pathology courses. Plant Path 123 I taught, and well, a bunch of other graduate courses at different times over my time in the department. So I've been a professor in the department since 1992. So that's how I ended up.
How did that tenure process work then?
It was really stressful, but not because anybody misbehaved. I think both departments were very supportive in their different ways. In terms of my personal life, about a year after my daughter was born, I met a guy who I eventually married, Don Waller, who's a professor in the botany department. And we started dating, and I was not very enthusiastic about getting married again. And he was
he was very focused on finding a wife. So that made me leery. And then I was on the job market, and it seemed very possible that I was going to go off to Kentucky or Pennsylvania or any of these other places where I was interviewing. So in the end, though, he wore me down, and we got married in 1994. And then I had another baby in 1995. And that really made it difficult in terms of the tenure track. I had two small kids. I did extend my tenure clock by 2 years, and I used them both. But that introduces a different kind of stress. There comes a point where you just feel like you're really old to be an assistant professor. At the point in time I went up, I was already chairing a major committee in the department and had for years. The department, the plant path department's relatively small. And I'm functional in terms of being able to convene a committee and make things happen. And I hope I say this without too much arrogance. Not all faculty actually are functional in that way. So the department was leaning on me, and yet I was still untenured. And I worried a lot about getting enough publications, getting enough grant funding. I remember having a discussion with Don. He said, well, I really think we should have another, I really want to have a child. He had no children at that point of his own. And I said, if I don't get NSF funding, I'm not going to get pregnant. So it was that, it was like truth. That. Well, it was
the truth.
I really felt sure. It would be professional suicide to have another kid before I had funding. Mm-hmm. So luckily, I got, I think that year, funding from both USDA and NSF. That gave me the confidence to go ahead and get pregnant. It took a long time for the publications to come, in part because I was doing a lot of teaching. The women's studies class involved learning stuff that I had never learned as an undergraduate biology major, where I'd always been interested in microbiology and molecular biology and plant biology. And here I was teaching a course on human neuroanatomy, human behavior. I had to learn all this psychology material. It was fun. It was a fun class to teach. Challenging, complicated, very fast moving, because there was always the question of why men and women think and behave differently, or if they do in fact think and behave differently, is one of perpetual fascination to, you know, the style page editors at any rate. And so there's a constant source of new stuff to talk about. And it was a required course for the women's studies program, so it was always filled and overfilled. I taught it as a writing intensive course because I felt strongly that it was a sufficiently complicated subject that students needed to grapple with it explicitly. That the forms of argumentation, what constitutes a solid line of evidence that supports your point of view in science, are quite different from those that would be a good argument for a feminist theory class, for example. So many of these students had to learn that you can't just say, this is a terrible paper because it's patriarchal. You have to say, this is a terrible paper because the sample size is inappropriate and the statistical analysis suggests there's no true difference between these two groups and there are these other factors that could explain their results. So getting the students to learn how to do that, it took some writing. And so anyway, all of which is to say, it was a time-consuming class to teach, even if it was also exciting and energizing. And then I was teaching various classes here in this department, trying to learn how to be a good mentor, which is to graduate students, which is another complicated task. And I had, oh Lord, some not so great students, other students that probably could have been better if I'd been a better mentor.
What were we talking about? You were talking about the tenure process, and okay. you said not only did you have the women's studies, but
yes.
Then the mentoring here.
Yes. I think mentoring graduate students, for me anyway, it just took me a while to develop the requisite confidence in my own judgment. I did not want to be the kind of mentor that my PhD advisor was. And he was very authoritarian, terrible listener, and also often not very well informed about the relevant science. Now, it must be said that every graduate student at one point or another thinks that their advisor is an idiot and ignorant. And my students are no exception, I'm sure. I wanted to try to find a more collaborative way of mentoring. And I think I began in a much too tentative way that didn't give them enough guidance. And I'm now a more directive mentor than I was. Some of that is just as you get older, you have more confidence in your judgment. It's easier to tell a graduate student, you know, cut that out and do it this other way, if you spend all your evening and weekend hours saying, pick up your socks and do your homework. you acquire a set of, you acquire the confidence in your own authority that comes from time and parenthood. Anyway, I had, I think, a not very distinguished assistant professorhood in terms of my research, and I spent a lot of time worrying about whether or not I was really good at my research and whether I would have been better at an all-teaching institution. On the other hand, my teaching went well. In 1998, I got a Chancellor's Teaching Award, which doesn't always happen to assistant professors. In fact, it's relatively unusual. And my teaching evaluations were a source of comfort and encouragement. And I enjoy the classroom. It's really, of course it's work, but it's also really fun. And A. E. Housman, you rejoice as the strong man rejoices to run a race. But bit by bit, I have become more confident in my research judgment and capacity. But that took longer.
But you made it through the tenure process.
I made it through the tenure process. As far as I know, without undue hoopla. Mm-hmm. I mean, apart from telling me that I needed to write more papers, the department was in general pretty positive. And I did get my NSF grant renewed, which is, renewal is often a competitive federal funding, mm-hmm. is, I now realize, since I just got done serving on the divisional committee, which makes tenure decisions for biology faculty, I now realize that getting a competitive federal grant and getting it renewed is a critical benchmark for tenure.
Now, has your lab always been in this building?
Yes. Women's Studies has no lab space.
Right.
So,
is it a good facility?
It's imperfect. The building is old, and we are very crowded. We're hoping to get, at some point, a new building, but realistically, it's got to be at least 10 years down the road. I would not say that it has hampered my research significantly. The main problem is that to do my work, I need to grow plants, and I need to grow them under very controlled conditions. And the growth chambers in the basement are expensive, limited in size, and prone to failure. And so we have had problems with valuable experiments that represented a big investment of time where the plants got cooked because the heating system in the growth chambers went out, or the lights blew up, or cockroaches came and ate all our tobacco once, but never again. They're for controlled growth facilities, they're not all that controlled. So that's been a source of some frustration. But in general, we've been able to do what we wanted to do.
Could you talk some more about your research? What has happened over the years? Is all of your work done in the lab, or do you go out into the field? Do you travel to do some of your research?
When I began, all my work was done in the lab. And so the larger question that's interesting to me is, mechanistically, how do bacteria learn to live inside plants and cause disease, or in some cases live inside plants, thrive, and not cause disease? As it happens, Ralstonia is very adept at living in plants without causing disease until the plant is stressed or some other signal that we don't understand is transmitted, and then it switches into pathogenic mode. So this is, in general, involved molecular biology experiments where we identify genes that control a process that we think might be involved in development of disease. like the ability to break down plant cell walls that I mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. or the ability to swim, to move toward more favorable conditions, swimming motility and chemotaxis have been studied in my lab. The ability to protect the bacteria to protect themselves from the plant's own defense response, which often takes the form of producing oxidative stress. Things like hydrogen peroxide and free oxygen radicals are produced by the plant when it senses the presence of a pathogen. And these molecules appear to be toxic to the plant. And then one of my students a few years ago did what is to date anyway the most interesting work that I've done in the lab, which was a broad open-ended screen that looked in general for bacterial genes that are upregulated, that is to say expressed, when the bacterium is living inside the plant relative to when the bacterium is living in the flask in the laboratory. And there we weren't asking, is motility important? Are plant cell wall degrading enzymes important? We were simply saying, what does the bacterium do when it's confronted with the plant? What functions does it have to upregulate? Mm-hmm. And this turned out to be just a gold mine of information. We're still trying to shovel through it. She identified 153 genes that are upregulated in the plant. And a tremendous piece of research. She's a wonderful student, mm-hmm. Darby Brown, now doing a postdoc at University of New Zealand, or University of Auckland in New Zealand. And so those were the kinds of questions that I was doing in the lab. But then, it really started in 1999. In 1999, the plant disease diagnostician in our department, Brian Huddleston, came up to me with some wilting geranium plants and said, these plants are sick, and usually when geraniums have wilt, they've got this one bacterium, but it's not this one bacterium. I wonder if it might not be Ralstonia solanacearum. And we did some tests, and sure enough, it was. And the disease had not been well described on geranium, and it had affected a number of greenhouses. So at that point, I thought, well, this is interesting. And I had an undergraduate who was doing a senior thesis in the lab, Lynn Williamson. And I said to Lynn, why don't you pursue this? So Lynn did. And it turned out that the particular kind of Ralstonia that was in these geranium plants, which had been imported from Guatemala, where they're produced in an offshore ornamental facility, had the particular kind of Ralstonia was something that's known as race 3 biovar 2. It was a particular subgroup of Ralstonia that attacks potatoes in the tropical highlands. And it's a quarantine pathogen that's not present in the United States. We have other kinds of Ralstonia solanacearum, but we don't have that particular kind. So she showed that the bacteria that came out of the potatoes out of the geraniums could cause disease on potatoes. We published a paper to that effect, which came out in 2001 while I was on sabbatical back in France. And then September 11th, 2001, and the APHIS, the USDA's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service, was asked to put together a list of plant pathogens that were potential biowarfare threats to the United States. And this whole process was shrouded in secrecy, so I don't know exactly what happened, but as near as I can piece it together, the American potato industry decided that this was a moment to engage in some trade protectionism against their old enemies, the Canadians, with whom they have an ongoing war, and they managed to get Ralstonia solanacearum race 3 placed on this select agents potential biowarfare list. And this turned out to have a bunch of ramifications that have affected my career ever since. And the first thing was that once it became a select agent, my collection, which I had inherited from Luis Sequeira, which numbers over 600 different strains from all over the world dating back to the 50s, suddenly became illegal for me to possess.
Oh, no.
And I needed to get special approval to continue to keep my own collection. Several of my colleagues around the country just put their stuff in the autoclave and killed it and destroyed, you know, careers worth of work, because the requirements for approval to work with select agents, which include you know, Marburg fever, Ebola virus, things that you might reasonably worry about as a potential biowarfare agent, smallpox. The list of plant pathogens is not nearly as scary. Ralstonia, for example, doesn't threaten human health, doesn't infect humans or animals, doesn't produce any toxins that affect humans or animals. It's a soil-borne pathogen, can't be sprayed out of an airplane, doesn't form spores or long-time resting structures. And its target, the potato, is not a major U.S. crop, so it's just not a scary thing, you know? If you were a terrorist, it probably would not be at the top of your list. Or so I have been trying to persuade the USDA these many years now. But in the meantime, we've had to comply with these requirements, which are a pain in the neck, to put it politely. I have to use a fingerprint reader and a smart card to get in, and so do all my students, to get in and out of the secret inner lab where we work with this one subgroup of strains. There's a motion-activated video camera that direct feeds to the UW police, so my students' work could be observed at any time. In order to be approved to work with these agents, my students and my technician and I all had to go through an FBI background check. We had to sign papers in which we promised that we weren't illegal drug users, that we had never had mental health problems, we'd never been dishonorably discharged from the Army. Other questions, some of which, like the mental health questions, could be construed as rather invasive. It takes a lot of time to keep up with the compliance paperwork. Okay, so it was a pain in the neck for us and it restricted our research. But worse was to come. About this time, got a call from the geranium industry. And the first outbreak in 1999 had not elicited much of any response. But there was a second accidental introduction, and this time on geraniums from Kenya, where race 3 is also common. And this was in early 2003. And the response of USDA was complete panic button. They ended up spending about $8 million trying to control this introduction. A few dozen infected plants were probably introduced into the U.S., and they ended up, because unrooted cuttings are introduced, are shipped in, and then rooted at rooting facilities where other plants became infected. They were sent out. I think in the end they found them in 126 greenhouses in 27 states. And at that time, no one knew really anything about the way this organism behaved on geraniums. And so whole greenhouses full of ferns and other things that we now know can't be infected by Ralstonia were all destroyed. People lost a great deal of money, and the geranium industry was really in a panic. So they persuaded me to go down to Guatemala and have a look at their production facilities and see if I could figure out where the pathogen was coming from. So I did this. I had never been to Guatemala before. It was fascinating experience in many different ways. And moreover, while I was down there, one of my colleagues here, Doug Maxwell, the same guy who persuaded me to come to graduate school here, was involved in a project in Guatemala to breed tomatoes for resistance to a virus. And he and his collaborator in Guatemala, a guy named Luis Mejia, who's a professor at the University of San Carlos in Guatemala, were having problems with a second disease when they were trying to do their virus resistance trials out in the field. The second disease, he thought, might be bacterial wilt. So he said, while you're down there talking to the geranium people, would you please stop by and look at our fields? So I did, and it was bacterial wilt. So that started a collaboration. And so a graduate student recommended by Luis Mejia came to my lab and did a master's project studying the Ralstonia strains in Guatemala and elsewhere in Central America, about which nothing was known. It was officially not even present in Guatemala, although we found three different kinds all over the country. And it got me started collaborating on this breeding project. We're now trying to breed tomatoes that are resistant to both the virus and bacterial wilt. So it ended up bringing a much more practical and applied tone to my lab, both because we got some funding from the floral industry to work on geraniums. So I had one person who was doing geranium studies here and in Guatemala, but mostly here. And then I had Amilcar Sanchez, this master's student, who was doing his master's work mostly in Guatemala. And then just sort of to top it off, Doug Maxwell and I taught a course in tropical plant pathology last fall and took a 2-week field trip of graduate students to Guatemala to see some of these diseases in the field. And that was really fun, although scary, just because Guatemala is not very safe. They're not some politically, things have calmed down a lot from the way they were during the Civil War, which ended titularly in 1996. Mm-hmm. But economically, it's still an extremely unequally distributed country, and there's lots of crime. And there's lots of car accidents. Driving is scary in Guatemala. So I was just, and people get sick. I mean, whenever I go down there, I always get sick. It's just the way it is. So I was worried about the students getting through, but in the end, it was fine.
So are you making progress on eradicating this?
Eradication's not an option. It's really very wily and well adapted. But breeding for resistance is an option, and yeah, I think we are slowly making progress. We're working not just with a breeder in Guatemala, but also with colleagues at the University of Florida, where there's a long time program breeding for resistance in tomatoes, and at something called AVRDC, the Asian Vegetable Research and Development Center in Kaohsiung, Taiwan, which is an international center for tomatoes, melons, peppers, eggplants, where there's seed bank and people doing research on various kinds of agronomic problems, especially disease resistance, and especially for tomatoes and peppers, Ralstonia. So anyway, it's a nice big multinational team, and it's fascinating.
It is.
I really like having a practical connection in my research, and most of my graduate students are still doing basic molecular biology, but they are inspired and excited by this connection to reality, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Two of my students who had never been to the developing world took this course, and it was a great thing. They came back really inspired. It became their problem to solve. You know, it wasn't just an abstract thing.
Absolutely.
And so I was very glad that they had that experience.
Yeah. You know, when you were first talking about the federal government getting in on all this, it's almost funny, except for the fact that it's so serious for you and
royal
your work.
Pain.
And, yeah.
Well, I didn't tell you the whole story, which is that this geranium company in Guatemala had a second, the first introduction was from Kenya, but then there was a second introduction in 2004 from Guatemala. And at that point, the USDA shut down all shipments from them in the middle of the season, and they went out of business. So this was a major U.S., I think it was at that time the largest U.S. producer of geraniums, Goldsmith plants. And they had 600 employees in Guatemala and 450 in Kenya, and they're almost all women, and they all lost their jobs. And they were, by Guatemalan standards, good jobs. There was a school for their kids, they had health care, there were literacy classes at night, they had vacations and bonuses when people stuck at the job for a while. They were an enlightened employer, and a major employer in this little town. And those jobs just vanished. There was nothing left but the sweatshops or nothing. And for these women who were mostly Maya, ethnically Maya, it was a blow. And for what? You know, for the stupid American potato industry. Yeah. And they didn't understand. I wrote a chapter in a book called Wages of Empire about globalization and women that's coming out. And Paradigm Press. Okay. And I interviewed some of the women workers about why they'd lost their jobs. And one of them said, well, it's a germ that can hurt, She said it's a germ that can hurt Americans, but it can't hurt Guatemalans.
Oh,
and I thought, it's just the opposite.
No kidding. Yeah, who's getting hurt here?
Who's getting hurt?
Wow.
Yeah.
Keep up the work.
You have to wonder sometimes if you're just documenting the disaster.
Well,
I hope that some of my students who take this course, I mean, they got mad in ways that I thought were good. We went to a sugarcane plantation, and sugarcane harvest was underway, and it's brutal work. They burn the fields, and then they send the harvesters in with machetes while everything's still smoking. It's unbelievably hot. It's down at ocean level, so it's really the heavy tropics. And these guys are paid, you know, 50 cents a bundle, which is a half a ton of sugarcane. And they're out there working. I've never seen such filthy human beings in my life. Mm-hmm. And my collaborator, Luis Mejia, who's with us, who has a gift for understatement, very serious guy, was talking to the students about this, and he said, it's work you can only do for a certain period of your life. So,
very sad.
It was, but it was, however, encouraging to see the students' responses and the way that they were saying, well, I won't be looking at sugar the same way again.
Good for them.
Yeah.
I think we're going to switch directions here now, and if you would talk, you mentioned earlier that you were on the divisional committee. Could you talk about your involvement in work outside your department, committee work, faculty governance, any other activities like that you're involved in?
I've done some various kinds of committee work, and this is going to sound just horrible, but it's dawned on me that I should only be doing important stuff. And after a certain number of committees where I just sat around and nothing happened except meetings all year long, I'm no longer willing to do any of that kind of thing. The divisional committee, however, felt important. And so I was on it for 3 years, chair in my last year. And that's a fascinating way to get to know science around the university, especially the differences in teaching and research expectations across the different colleges. In the School of Medicine versus LNS, radically different ideas about what they think an associate professor should look like in the biological sciences. It's routine in LNS for professors to teach two full classes and two seminars a year.